Welcome to Crosspoint.
Welcome to Crosspoint.
Welcome to Crosspoint.
We are an inclusive faith community
seeking to live out the loving, just, and generous way of Jesus.
We are participants in a long tradition
that's less concerned with doctrines and dogma that demand total agreement,
but a life to be lived, enjoyed, and given away to others.
What unites us is a growing awareness that life is precious,
that we are made by love in order to love.
This community is comprised of and affirms the entire human family,
regardless of race, age, creed,
physical abilities, marital or economic status,
gender identity, or sexual orientation.
So, if you are curious and have come to see,
if you are tired and have come to rest,
if you are grateful and have come to share,
if you are wounded and have come to heal,
if you are joyful and have come to celebrate,
if you are uprooted and have come to belong,
welcome home.
Welcome home.
Welcome home.
Welcome home.
This message will start in Louisiana and then widen to Western society as a whole. Then, after loosely meandering through thousands of years of human history and a brief sociology lesson, I think I'm trying to provide an aha as we think about gender and the stories that we're telling about gender, and we don't realize maybe that we're telling and internalizing stories. I'm not going to exhaustively cover or settle anything, so prepare to be a little disappointed. But yeah, that's because of the constraints of time and the limits of my intelligence and education. I'm promising you're going to have more questions when I'm finished talking, not less. So you're welcome. Here we go. First, Louisiana. Last week, Louisiana enacted legislation requiring public school classrooms in the, across the state to display the Ten Commandments in every classroom, a specific version of them. What is that specific version? Well, here's the exact wording from the bill. You can go look it up yourself. That was signed into law. It says, "The text shall read as follows, the Ten Commandments. I am the Lord thy God. Thou shalt have no other gods before me. Thou shalt not make to thyself any graven images. Thou shalt not take the name of the Lord thy God in vain. Remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy. Honor thy father and thy mother, that thy days may be long upon the land which the Lord thy God giveth thee. Thou shalt not kill, thou shalt not commit adultery, thou shalt not steal, thou shalt not bear false witness against thy neighbor. Thou shalt not covet thy neighbor's house. Thou shalt not covet thy neighbor's wife, nor his manservant, maidservant, his cattle, nor anything that is thy neighbor's." Now, obviously, this is English. Originally, of course, these commands were written in Hebrew, which raises the question, what version, what translation of the text are these commandments? Well, that's tricky, because what we call the Ten Commandments, the Bible doesn't call them Ten Commandments, they're called the Ten Words, but what we're calling the Ten Commandments are presented in three different places in the Old Testament, and they're all different from each other. So, for generations and generations, it has been known to Jewish people that these 10 words, they vary depending on where you're reading them in the Torah. And so following and observing these commandments, you have to do it thoughtfully and with a tolerance for nuance. And so even in the original language, before we even get to this translation, it's not as straightforward as the 10 commandments. It just never has been. And how the commandments are numbered, that's a whole other argument. Catholics and Protestants number them differently. There are other traditions that I could mention in there, so they're broken down in different ways. But it gets far more puzzling than all of this. Let's assume, since it says thy and thou in the Louisiana version, that they're using the King James Bible. Well, here's how the King James Bible version renders the command. It says, "Thou shalt have no other gods before me. Thou shalt not make unto thee any graven sacred image or any likeness of anything that is in heaven above or that is in the earth beneath or that is in the water under the earth." Louisiana's version, it simply says and requires, "Thou shalt have no other gods before me. Thou shalt not make to thyself any graven images." That's a lot less words. than the command actually reads. This is a reduced version, and the reduced version of the verse omits tons of important context about not creating false gods from phenomenon in the sky, maybe weather phenomenon, animals. Remember, the Israelites struggled with this. They got nervous as a group at one point and melted their jewelry and made a golden cow to worship it. This has a precise meaning and intent originally. So when you chop all that stuff out, you're making a theological decision to say, let's make it universal for everybody, even all of us who weren't there. And that's strange, because if it's universal, then how do you do it? How do you observe it? No other gods, no images carved or created to evoke reverence. Well, lots of people make a case that that affects things that'll still be in that classroom. I mean, can you still have the kids pledge allegiance to the flag, that thing we won't allow to touch the ground? It's so sacred. Can the school still use money since our currency depicts our dead leaders and with the phrase, "In God we trust"? And this is a tangent, but you might notice that the law uses the lowercase g for other gods, despite ancient Hebrew not having upper and lowercase. This is a decision about which gods are legitimate and which gods are not legitimate, which of course religions do, but this is the government telling kids which gods are valid. So, as is common, the ancient text has been recontextualized by omitting, taking out the parts that you can't make apply to the modern context. Everybody does this. And so we can assume that's what's happening. Like it happens again here. The command reads, "I am the Lord thy God." And that it leaves out the rest that says, "I am the Lord thy God who brought you out of the land of Egypt, the house of bondage." Well, we can't use that. Egypt, house of bondage, that doesn't apply to us. That's specifically for a people and a time and a place. So you crop that part out because you're omitting that which is not applicable to our own context now. But where do they get this version of the Bible that makes these recontextualizing decisions? Louisiana legislators, they didn't, so far as anybody knows, hire a bunch of scholars and experts to get this right. Well, the legislators adopted their version of the Ten Commandments, not from the original Hebrew, nor from the 64 official Christian biblical translations that you can find online or buy in a store. They got it from a 2005 U.S. Supreme Court case, Van Orden versus Perry. So it's not simply an excerpt from the Bible. They got it from a court case. And the Bible, without a doubt, played a role in how this nation was, its laws were framed, how the founders were thinking. Of course, this is a particular way of framing this text that doesn't seem, to appreciate the separation of church and state by making classrooms post-it. But it also doesn't appreciate the absolutely critically important work of thinking through how a particular religious text, one from the Iron Age, no less, should or shouldn't be mapped onto the modern world, our modern context, especially by an allegedly secular government. So here's the first sort of sharp turn I'm going to make. And this might for a second feel like a stretch or a non sequitur, but it's not. This is all on a continuum of understanding. About the absolutes that some of us think that we're appealing to, but they're actually stories we're telling and that we don't realize that we're telling them. The parts of these commands being left out, one way or another, are being left out so that the meaning and the relevance can be universalized. We recontextualize it for ourselves. And that makes sense. So you cut out Egypt, you omit fashioning idols from sea animals. I mean, we don't do that. We don't struggle with that. That's not useful. So the context has changed, and so it's adapted. Okay, here's the text of the last commandment to be put on posters for kids in those classrooms. Thou shalt not covet thy neighbor's house. Thou shalt not covet thy neighbor's wife, nor his manservant, nor his maidservant, nor his cattle, nor anything that is thy neighbor's. The thing omitted from this one, and different from how it actually reads in the Bible, is that it also says donkey. So it doesn't just say you shouldn't covet or desire his cattle. It's oxen and donkey. And that might be because the cattle part's still relevant. You know, there's a huge cattle industry in the West. But not so much donkeys. I mean, you might know somebody that has a donkey, but they don't, it's not a pack animal. It's, they have it because it's cute, most likely. We don't use donkeys anymore. So I can't be 100% certain, but it seems that this has been adjusted for context. And just take the donkey part out. But what was not adjusted, what has been left in and full, as if to say, no, that part's universal, we can carry that into our modern world perfectly and map it onto our lives, is the rendering of wives as property. On a list with farm animals and servants, and listed second to the guy's house. Could have just as easily adjusted it for our modern context to say, don't desire your neighbor's spouse, or reduce it even further, just to get to the moral of it, to say, don't envy other people's lives and circumstances. But other than the donkey being omitted from the 10th command, because what year is it? It's 2024. Nobody uses a donkey anymore. Wives belong to my neighbor, who by default is a man. It's my neighbor is a man who owns all that stuff. It wasn't adjusted to say, don't covet my neighbor's husband or you know, let alone including all the same-sex couples. You can't do that, right? It's presented as a man who possesses her as well as everything else, and it's not been adjusted at all. Why? Well, you could say, oh, it's because what the Bible says, but we've already covered you can manipulate things to change it, to apply it to your modern life. This is patriarchy. The answer of why this happens is patriarchy, which simply means a society in which men, the eldest, the father, the older brother, men, they're not only in charge, but they are something more than the women. And it's been around for thousands of years. It's been around in countless cultures. And it's still here. Here in the U.S., the hub of modernity and progressive society, still the default framing for the roles, the implied values of gender, of the genders. So post it in every classroom. Enshrine it subtly but unquestioningly, the story that women and girls are something less than men and boys because the world belongs to men and boys. And fold it in with this enshrinement that's happening in Louisiana right now, but you know, it'll probably happen in other ways in other places. Folded into this is the source and the reinforcement of stories that we tell about gender more broadly and sexuality. And I don't mean to sound dramatic when I say that the unflinching willingness for the government to post those words after already showing a liberty, a felt freedom to edit the wording for context, an unflinching willingness to do this is why women are still thought of as requiring permission to live their lives in ways men don't have to. They require permission to do what they want still in many circles, where young women can still at their graduation hear a commencement speech about true happiness being found by them remaining one of the entries on their husband's list of assets. And this enshrined patriarchy, it's sexist and it's misogynistic and it's dehumanizing of women. This story we keep telling but act like, well, no, it's not a story. It's just, it's simple facts. It's nature. All this means that having traits, interests, and behaviors that the culture has decided those belong to women, those are feminine, that will negatively affect how others treat you. This is why, and I'm speaking in generalities here, I'm sure there are plenty of exceptions, but this is why women can wear makeup or not wear. They cannot wear makeup and put on suit pants and a tie and go to work. And somebody might disagree with their fashion choices, but it's not really going to cost her anything in almost any circle. But a man wearing makeup and putting on a dress, if that's what he wanted to do, that moves away from quote-unquote masculinity. And so that would cost him by degrees. It would cost him respect, inclusion, safety. I mean, unless it's Halloween or an 80s sitcom, it will cost him to do that, because he's moving away from the story of manhood that we tell. And that story says that men are something more than women. Little girls, they can be tomboys. That's cute. But there's no equivalent for a boy, because if a boy behaves like a girl, that will cost him. It'll make his parents worry. It makes him the object of shame, maybe even abuse. And I know it's different now, but it's not completely gone. And some of you know this personally. Walk into a room and say, hey guys, without considering what the genders are. And most of the time, no one bats an eye. Walk into a room and say, hey, ladies, and you're trying to be funny. You're saying something negative about everybody. That's taken as a put down. Because in a patriarchy, masculinity, as defined by men, is the top of the social food chain. And so you either are that, you get as close to that as you can to benefit from it, or you fall from it to your own shame. Now, there's an entire argument against what I'm saying, at least one, about how the issue is God made men to be men and women to be women. And it's not about who's worth more, because their value and worth is the same. But it's about roles that we play. I understand these arguments. I think I've probably heard all of them. I'm willing to say it's possible I haven't. On my most charitable days, I can agree with the little parts of it, even though the gender binary is obviously reductive and false. I want to address the part of this argument that says that these roles are God-given, that this was God's idea, and that God requires it of people of true faith who want to be good and right to live the way that they're supposed to, that God specifically determined men's role as leader and bosses and heads of household, pastors. Women can work at a church, but they have to be a director, right? Or they can be the pastor of the children. But once the kids go through puberty, then they're, you know, those boys are now men and they're in control. This has been touted for generations, and it's still happening near you, as something God designed and desires and demands, and anything else is off. It's sinful. It's rebellious. So there's tons of ways to come about this, and we talk about it all the time. But here's a way to see that this claim is, in my opinion, at least naive. Aristotle, who you might recall isn't in the Bible, said silence is a woman's glory. He also said the female is a female by virtue of a certain lack of qualities. Sophocles said silence gives the proper grace to women. Euripides said a woman's noblest station is retreat, withdrawal. Her fairest virtues fly from public sight. Euripides said a man who teaches a woman Latin is a fool, for he is providing poison for a serpent. Plato said, it is only males who are created directly by the gods and are given souls. Those who live rightly return to the stars, but those who are cowards or lead unrighteous lives may with reason be supposed to have changed into the nature of women in the second generation. Pythagoras said, there is a good principle which created order, light, and man, and an evil principle which created chaos and darkness and woman. Hippocrates, the father of medicine, said a woman's body is inherently defective and capable only of bearing children. The Buddha said women with their two fingers worth of wisdom have a difficult time seeing truth. Confucius said a woman's place is in the home. Thomas Aquinas said the male sex is more noble than the female, and for this reason he is more powerful, more distinguished, more remarkable. Napoleon said, nature intended women to be our slaves. They are our property. We are not theirs. He also said women are nothing but machines for producing children. Martin Luther, father of the Protestant Reformation, one of the reasons Crosspoint exists, if we're being honest, he said the word and works of God is quite clear. Women were made either to be wives or prostitutes. Schopenhauer said, women are by nature meant to obey. Nietzsche said, woman was God's second mistake. Jean-Jacques Rousseau said, women in general are not attracted to art at all, nor knowledge, and not at all to genius. This is about half the assembled list that I had. I decided to cut it short, and I left out the insulting ones. So let's ask ourselves, are these guys inspired by God to say these things about women, to have these views about women? Did the Holy Spirit of Jesus inspire Buddha with the truth when he said they only have two fingers worth of wisdom and struggle to know what's true? Did God whisper the truth to Aristotle and Sophocles like he did to the Apostle Paul, that it's best when women just shut up and go home? Or isn't it more likely that sexist, ignorant men talk like this sometimes? Men who might have all these other gifts and contributions that we should be grateful for can still be jackasses when it comes to how they speak of and treat the women in their lives. Isn't that probably what's happening? See, patriarchy isn't inspired. And if it is, well, then so are the words of Buddha, Napoleon, and Nietzsche. And that uncle that we all have who rolls his eyes and has to say female doctor. Patriarchy isn't divinely created. It wasn't God's idea. It's no more unique to specific parts of Christianity or to the Bible than war or animal sacrifice is. It just happens all the time. Patriarchy is something a lot of dudes have just come up with over and over and over, insisting it's right and good. And sure, all people have value. I mean, women are people. I don't know any people who are pro-patriarchy who'd say women aren't people. It's just that it says that only half of us are like adult people. And so guys that look like this, humans that look like this, we're in charge. And here we are. And this problem radiates. It leaks outward. It's negatively affecting women and has for thousands of years, which means it's negatively affecting men because it's false. But, and just as importantly, posting that 10th commandment wording for kids to internalize in those classrooms, the mindset that thinks that that's the right thing to do, that same mindset, that same spirit is what makes being gay, lesbian, trans, asexual, non-binary, queer, just single, makes it an unnecessarily living hell. Because there's a narrowness in it that drives our fellow image bearers of God into hiding, into pretending, into self-shaming, or out of their homes, often at a very young age, into despair, dehumanization, into danger, all because there's stories we don't know we could be telling differently. So there's several valid things to discuss here, and I hope that the discussion will happen. But I want to talk in some admittedly brief ways about the gender story we've heard and that we tell. Because I think there's so many things to talk about, sexuality and really, really dig into gender. But I think focusing briefly on gender specifically opens up all those other discussions sort of automatically. We have inherited in the Western culture the idea, the story of gender as a binary, masculinity and then femininity, and they're separate and they're opposite. Anything outside of this binary is commonly understood as aberrant or deficient, illegitimate, evil, crazy. Often people will use the word unnatural. Not all cultures do this. For some cultures, there's three genders. For some, there's over a dozen. Some hold that gender is a spectrum and you can move through it fluidly. The ancient Jewish world identified essentially six genders. Maybe you've heard indigenous or First Nation people use the term two-spirit persons, that's somebody revered as sacred because they present masculine and feminine characteristics simultaneously. So this is pretty common. But there are no known societies that have no concept of gender. Why might that be? Well, there are several theories that sociology is built on that can help us understand the stories we've inherited. It's helpful for me when we talk about gender. There is something called structural functional theory. And structural functional theory holds that our behaviors that we enact, that we choose, we do that because we have the sense that that holds our society together and keeps it working. So gender, and through this lens, is thought to be a huge part of how human beings are organizing their world by assigning clear, distinct roles for everybody. So some anthropologists think that this began in hunter-gatherer societies where men, who are generally physically stronger, they went out and killed the big game, defended against predators or against invading tribes. Women, who are generally less physically strong, they stayed behind to take care of the children, to take care of things back home. And so then these roles became sort of set in stone. Like, this is how it has to be with everything. And so it became institutionalized. Well after physical strength was a main factor for survival, everybody kept living that way. The problem with a theory like this is that it gets wrong or overemphasizes the big game hunting and the daily dangers and all that. Because fishing, small game hunting, gathering fruit, that was the daily way of surviving. Women did all that. And these things were far more common to what it meant to daily life back then. And then so other scientists say patriarchy emerged about 12,000 years ago with the advent of agriculture and homesteading. As people began settling down, acquiring resources that they needed to defend, the power shifted to the physically stronger males who could go get it and defend it. And then property was being passed down to the sons and the nephews who could protect that hard-earned property from being lost. And so gradually, women and girls get edged out of the equation. They lose their power, their influence, and then even their autonomy. And agriculture and homesteading stayed with us. They're still at the root of so much of society. So these stories have hung on, but we forgot it's a story. For most of recorded history since, male domination was just accepted as fact. I mean, nobody had named a concept of patriarchy back then. Male supremacy was taken for granted. You take it unthinkingly, like it's just nature, you know, as unremarkable. Who would say that's a four-legged horse or that's hot fire? That just is that way. And so men dominated everything and didn't know it was a story that didn't need to be. And then they created and wrote for the benefit of other men. They wrote laws and literature and philosophy and history and medicine and science, reinforcing the story so much that everybody forgot there was any other way. It's a story, though. A story that we've given the power to demand we conform to it in order to be seen as physically and mentally healthy, fit for inclusion, romantically desirable, or even good, capital G good. And we should say this story isn't as universally clung to now. Shifts have happened and are happening. You can see it. Men, for instance, are working from home, and that's not as taboo as it was just 20 years ago. Women are leading and influencing the world profoundly. The nuclear family isn't dominant in our minds anymore, like it very recently was. Science has changed how we see these things. Frankly, the influence of very brave women and queer folks has made it clear that these old stories of straight male domination aren't to be assumed like they once were. So it is shifting. More and more the story of gender roles is expanding and changing. So structural functionalism is the story of how gender roles are assigned to hold our society together, to organize and simplify our environment. Then there's the theory called symbolic interaction theory, and it explains gender as something a person does, rather than like a state or something innate or something imposed on us. It's something we do. Gender is something we do. Clothing, hairstyle, makeup, body language, the depth of our voice, these telegraph gender to other people. When I was a kid, I was told if you step in something and you want to see the bottom of your foot, a boy will turn his foot and look at the sole of his foot on the inside, and a girl will look over her shoulder and kick her foot backward to look and see what she stepped in. And I remember thinking, that's true. And so be careful not to look over your shoulder at the sole of your foot, or you're a girl or gay. And that was a story. I just thought it was true. A lot of us did. Women are socialized to do gender in very specific ways. To show respect in a conversation, that a woman is more likely to make eye contact to show that she's listening, to smile and encourage the other speaker. If you don't believe me, watch what some people call a woman who doesn't do these really simple things in conversation. And then watch what we call men who don't do them, if we even notice that they're not doing them. Women have to do gender one way. Men do gender another way. Crossing your legs is ladylike, but sitting with your legs spread out is what? Man-spreading. Masculine traits are associated with power, taking up more space, controlling conversations. So gender is a thing that we do. It's a story that we enact with our being, with our bodies. And when people don't do gender according to the story that we enshrine, people freak out a little bit. Something is wrong here. People will fear and will say that they fear that power dynamics and social order, morality can be threatened and toppled by doing gender wrong. Now, symbolic interaction theory can be somewhat limited in what it's analyzing because it gets so focused on the minutia of an individual life, an individual gender enactment. At the expense of the larger picture of gender inequality that can exist in a system. So the third theory that we could touch on is called social conflict theory, understood through the lens of gender conflict theory. And that argues that gender functions as a structural system that is sort of designed to give power and privilege to some while disadvantaging others. And so that system is patriarchy. a social framework in which men have more power and dominate the other genders. Historically, in this country, that's been super easy to see. Women disadvantaged by not being able to be in the spaces men are in. Disadvantaged by not being allowed to access those spaces for societal, where societal power is influenced, where it lies. Not allowed to access higher education. They couldn't vote. They weren't allowed to lead in their countries, their country, their community. Being effectively reduced to children in their towns, in their churches, in their homes, all while having to stage themselves and their bodies, their presentation, as desirable. All while being burdened with making sure that the men in their lives feel honored and respected by them, agreed with by them, that they remain attractive to them, all that. So those things have improved. They've changed. I'm not saying that. I'm hearing a lot of women and even feminists that will admit, but so much of that has changed in the last century. But ask a woman, how does it go in a boardroom for you compared to how it seems to be going for men? Or at the school or the town council meeting, or when you go get your oil changed, how does that go? Ask and then listen, because their experience is still often marked by a relative disadvantage within spaces where there are men, and the story of patriarchy is still being assumed and internalized and told. It's better, but it's still there. And watch what happens to so many men who hear them explain their experience, and rather than listening and understanding, the men will center themselves as though they are being personally judged and attacked, and then they'll give all their energy to defending themselves or discounting what they just heard the woman say. It's easy to think this is all in the past, but if we'll listen and really listen, there has been a ton of improvements, but it's not behind us yet. And that is perhaps because patriarchy is less out in the open, like it, at least compared to how it used to be. Often now it's more subtle. I sometimes think of it as a blatant subtlety, like the wording of that 10th commandment. That's to me a blatant subtlety of patriarchy, an old story still being fought for. But with it seems like it's got less mean-spiritedness than the old days. And that's especially true in evangelical spaces, that blatant subtlety. Despite the fact that the Jesus and the Gospels we're all reading scandalizes the established stories of gender with his affirming and dignifying and collaborating and doing ministry with women, so many of those who proclaim the name of Jesus seem to be the most vocal about women remaining quiet and, you know, stay behind the men in all things. You can walk in any direction here in the South, and within a mile, I bet you can find multiple women who would say women aren't good leaders because they're too emotional. I mean, have you ever noticed that the word hysterical and hysterectomy are related by their prefix? That means womb. The story of gender inequality is baked into our vocabulary. That's how deep the story is. Jordan Klepper, by the way, pointed out that all wars have been started by men, but patriarchy continues to warn us that women in leadership they're going to overreact and get us into trouble. Society values rational leaders, which we associate with men and masculinity. And displaying sensitivity and emotion, that's associated with irrationality and weakness, femininity. And that story is still super popular. You cry like a little girl, not like a little boy, right? It's still the default story for how we frame and shame the expression of feelings versus fact, or fear versus courage, or reluctance to inflict harm versus don't let them get away with that. And it's a bad story. And we keep telling it to our kids. We're letting them repeat these stories. It's a bad story, and we have to see that we still have it in us, and it's not simply nature. It's not something God has designed. We have to see it's a bad story that we're telling, and it exists because we haven't yet agreed to a better one. And it must be said, by the way, the gender conflict theory and the stories told from that thinking, it's far more complex than simply saying patriarchy means men first and women second. There's way more to it, because that has never meant black men, not in this country. And a white woman may still be at the mercy of the patriarchal system to some degree, but not as much as a black woman. But then there's black trans women, and on and on and on. It's complicated. What I'm describing is captured in this study called Intersectionality, and that observes the very real crossroads of race and gender and class and sexual orientation, all kinds of things, and how those stories increase or decrease one's experience of equality and justice, autonomy, respect, et cetera, et cetera. And so I hope that those of us who want to really understand this, despite what might feel like a lot of overwhelming and disorienting nuance about something we were told was just this or this, I hope you'll become a student of it, of intersectionality, of how patriarchy isn't simply men and women complementing each other's strengths and weaknesses, but how it demands that people conform or be cast out, or worse. So putting an effort to learn here, that's at least part of what we mean when we say we're trying to love our neighbor, because we know we can't love what we will not seek to better understand and make sure feels better understood. So I've spoken against patriarchy, not against men, but against the system that privileges men and then blames God for the system. Patriarchy always disadvantages women and wounds men with narrow definitions of what a man can look like or be. Patriarchy, at the same time, functions as the mechanism behind the marginalization and shaming and dehumanizing and endangerment of LGBTQ folks. Because ultimately, in this country, patriarchy puts straight white men at the top and little asterisks and warnings next to everybody else. I am, if it's not clear to you on screen, a straight white man. And here I am commanding your attention on this meandering talk about patriarchy and gender, trying to further involve anybody willing to listen in the work of telling a better story. So how do we do this? Because I'm not suggesting we get better at debate. It doesn't work to hear this and commit ourselves to arguing with everybody, going on a correction tour, shaming the shamers and everybody who disagrees. Well, you know, Confucius proves it. I'm trying to be helpful, but debate isn't going to change anything. Our pathway, as always, is remembering we're talking about people living their lives. We all know people who have been shamed or wounded for the way that they've lived or hidden their gender story. I might be talking about you. So this isn't an issue or a headline. This is people and their actual lived lives. The systems we construct and expand or live by or resist or inflict on each other, those are real too. But it's people, human beings, and their human lives that we're addressing. Lives as real and as rich and as complex as yours. So our war must not be against people. In fact, it's not a war. War is patriarchy's default metaphor, and often not a metaphor, the literal strategy. We aren't declaring war, even as we're being accused of declaring war. The war on men, the war on masculinity, the war on traditional gender roles. That's their story. We're not scripted by their story. We must put thoughtful, intelligent effort into seeing and retelling more humane stories. Ours is not a war. It's the lived story of love and justice and kindness and peace and the freedom to express what God has made, not what someone else allows. And so here, my friend Gareth Higgins, an author and activist, I hope that you'll go check out his work. He's meant a lot to me over the years. He's shaped my thinking on all of this to an incredible extent. He framed the work of telling better gender stories so well that I'm just going to read what he said recently for the next few moments. He said, "So here I am, a man inviting all of us and all our gender expressions to consider the following. Don't conflate anecdotes with trends. There is a whole lot of shaking going on in our world, including an aggressive backlash to gender expansiveness. But the reason there is an aggressive backlash is that a compassionate and creative reevaluation of the gender story is manifestly underway, and there's more space than ever to rewrite it. Two, don't conflate individuals with policies. One guy making a misguided speech about his sincerely held but not very well-informed sexist beliefs does not have to colonize our minds. What we should be more concerned with is that the vision of masculinity that equates manhood with dominance is asserting itself in public life and political policy. Sometimes it needs to be opposed. Mostly it needs an alternative. Three, look for what's behind the fear or concern. Ask yourself what legitimate needs might be driving the expression of angst, concern, insecurity, prejudice, or worse. Beneath all anger is fear, say the mystics. And beneath fear is love of what we feel we might be losing. The world is full of uncertainty and people are deeply insecure to begin with. The antidote to insecurity is not to push people to feel more insecure or to pretend their insecurity or concerns don't exist. It's possible to validate the experience of uncertainty without endorsing the content of their insecurity. To offer something more secure instead is even better." Then Gareth says, "C, Seek initiation as individuals and into communities where people treat each other as they would want to be treated, who go the extra mile in a life of service, who bring what they have and ask for what they need in service and honor to the cosmic and common good. Our entire culture needs this kind of initiation, and I believe it is already happening. And to people, men in particular, who find yourself speaking harshly about gender, I want to say this. The most important difference between people is not between alpha males and submissive females, but between those of whatever gender who advocate dominance and those who advocate self-giving love. Don't do any harm, even in the way you talk about gender. Allow your life to flourish in the light of the kaleidoscopic grace of the human family and all its genders and archetypes. Come on in. The better story about gender and its most authentic form is not a threat to anyone. It is an invitation for everyone. You don't have to stop identifying with or being whatever gender authentically calls to you. Like any other story, what matters most is if it provokes you to become more of what a person is for, to learn to love and to be loved. So, my dear family and friends of every description and expression, may we continue together to live out and make room for more honest, expansive stories. And may we flourish in the light of the kaleidoscopic grace of the human family. Amen.
If you would like to know more or get connected to Crosspoint, go to crosspoint.org. If you're in need of care or assistance, go to crosspoint.org/care. And welcome home.